Technology and Images, Who Speaks Our Language, was presented by Casey Pilcher with a response by Wes Hurd on October 20, 2007, at the 2007 Oktoberfest entitled Reading Minds, Dialogues Between Two Generations. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
So our next presenter is Casey Pilcher. Casey is currently a junior at Gutenberg College and hails from Portland. And her topic is technology and images, and I will be the one who interacts with her following her presentation. Casey.
Is this is on. I need to get the technology to tell you about technology. I actually thought about asking you all to turn your cell phones on. Then we could see how many phone calls we got. We could rate the ringtones. I thought that would be kind of fun. The full title of this segment is actually Technology and Images, Whose Language Do We Speak? I have to tell you, I'm not going to be answering the question, Whose Language Do We Speak? It's a great question. As I started delving into the aspects and issues about being a technological society and an image-based culture, it became so clear that first and foremost, we have to understand our relationship to technology. So I spent a lot of time talking with people from both generations about the role that technology plays in our lives. In doing so, I began to realize that I would have a really tough time representing my generation. And I'm putting myself in the postmodern camp. Which opinion do I represent? We are as fiercely protective of our technology as we are hateful. I learned that this is actually not a neutral subject. So I spent also quite a bit of time talking to the modern generation, mostly my dad, and found that, not surprisingly, they had a very different perspective of technology. Just a quick note about how much has changed. In my dad's world, he grew up on a couple thousand acres in Denver, Colorado. My dad's a cowboy. He works the land. He still works the land. It took him all summer to put up the hay, which they did only by horses and two hands. Today, I'm a project manager in wireless telecom, just part-time, but that's my job. It's a very different world. If I had to sum up the purpose of technology for each generation, it would be this. For the modern generation, my dad's generation, societal technology is what I want to call it. I had to come to a couple of categories because so much has changed between the purpose. So for my dad's technology, it's societal. For our technology, it's modern. I'm sorry, it's personal. So societal technology versus personal technology. For the modern, technology serves society. For the postmodern, technology serves the individual. So my goal is to wrap my arms around how technology affects our humanity. Not a small issue. Although both generations have very different perspectives, it became clear that it influences all equally. And where I found that it perhaps is the most influential is in its unintended consequences. I'll just repeat that. Technology influences us most in its unintended consequences. What do I mean by that? To give you a really good example, I'm going to use one of the great books. I'll refer to one of Plato's dialogues between Socrates and Phaedrus. In it, Socrates gives a wonderful speech about technology. He describes the invention of letters, the alphabet, through a really wonderful story. An inventor went to the king of Egypt with his invention of letters, asking that the king impart it to all Egyptians. He explained, "This invention, O king, will make the Egyptians wiser, and it will improve their memories. It is an elixir of memory and wisdom that I have discovered." But the king replied, "One man has the ability to beget arts, but the ability to judge of their usefulness belongs to another. And now you, who are the father of letters, have been led by your affection to describe to them a power the opposite of that which they really possess. For this invention will produce forgetfulness in the minds of those who learn to use it, because they will not practice their memory. Their trust in writing produced by external characters will discourage the use of their own memory within them. You have invented an elixir not of memory, but of reminding. Unintended consequences. I'd like to focus on three. Technology constantly gives rise to new technology. Secondly, I think it reinvents culture. And thirdly, I think it shapes our perception of reality. So, not surprising, technology gives rise to new technology. It does this in several ways. Technology, we all know, it causes a lot of problems. But the causer of the problems is always the solution, which is new technology. The other aspect, though, is that it's never enough. It's never fast enough. It's never satisfying enough. It's never, you know, whatever. This morning I was printing this out, and my computer kept crashing as it was connected to my my printer. And I was just, the irony of it was so funny, because I was just so, like, when are we going to get these things to work? So I'd like to illustrate the concept that it's never enough, and that technology is always, in the cyclical aspect, always becoming second, third, fourth generation, by looking at the process of the debate throughout history. And it'll become clear what I mean. In 1858, between Abraham Lincoln and Stephen A. Douglas, they had debates in Illinois. This was for the presidential election, of course. Typically, in their day, the debate process didn't last for hours. It actually lasted for days. And in this particular debate, it lasted for 7 days. All the while, the audience just sat calmly listening. Problem is, meeting in the public has its limitations. What do we do when the Grange Hall gets too full? What do we do when the sun goes down and we still need to go bring the cows into the barn? So there must be a better way to make the content of this debate more accessible to the people. So fast forward to my dad's youth. Radio is a wonderful venue for public debate. It definitely brought public discourse into the homes. Excellent. We've made the content of the debate accessible. Now families all across America can sit in the comfort of their own kitchens and listen to the debate for hours. Maybe not hours. But the problem was, it would be really nice to see those who were debating. Sitting around the radio has lost something. We can hear them, but we can't see them. And so sets the stage for television. During my dad's day, he got to see some of the first political debates become live on TV. Of course, they weren't over 7 days. And perhaps not as long as what one would have on the radio, I'm not sure. But, you know, the thought was, goal attained. We got the debate into the homes, and now people could actually see who was debating. The content is more accessible. Or is it? In the presidential campaign of 1952, the most significant innovation related to the role of television in politics is the use of the commercial, not the televised debate. That's 1952. That started almost instantly. You think of how soon we got television and how quickly the debate process actually moved out of being the informing process. Okay, fast forward to 1992, the national election. Parties spent over $122 million for commercials, and studies show that the television viewer actually learned more from the commercials themselves than actually from the debates. So fast forward to debate, to today. What is the latest tool now? YouTube. Do you guys all know YouTube, generally? Yeah, you guys know YouTube, okay. I watched the pertinent points of a political debate between the Democratic hopefuls. It lasted 7 minutes. 7 minutes. We went from a 7-day debate in public space to a 7-minute debate in cyberspace. We are trying to make the content more accessible. We've certainly made it more accessible. Obviously, we haven't made the content. The content didn't go over in the translation. Certainly, YouTube was not created to be the atmosphere in which political issues will be thoughtfully discussed, but that's what it's being used for, and for other things. But it diminished the quality to just sound bites. So technology has unintended consequences. Its cyclical nature, side effects, and dissatisfaction means it will never be good enough. Okay. Is that right? Yeah. Okay. Let's consider that technology reinvents culture. This is a little bit harder to grasp, but actually hearing the first two segments, that might be more believable to you guys. I was talking to my dad about this lecture and about trying to narrow it down to something relevant. So I asked him, Dad, if you were giving this lecture when you were a college student, what would you talk about? He thoughtfully paused and said, space age. You can't talk about technology and not talk about the space age. And of course, my instant reaction is, Star Trek? He's all, no, Neil Armstrong. Man walking on the moon. It is an excellent point. It actually hadn't even occurred to me. Man made it to the moon. This brought his generation tremendous optimism. He said that technology for his culture brought optimism and it brought possibility. And if he had to equate technology with one word, it would be development. I asked him to tell me more. He mentioned that virtually every technological apparatus was going from mechanical to electronic. He gave me an example. With a telephone, the call used to go through an operator who would stand there and manually make the switch to connect the call. Well, that job was being replaced by an electronic switch that would, you know, like what we have today. So I asked him, well, what did that do for your culture? Well, we had to get jobs that were going to be around in 30 years. They could see the telephone operators were being replaced by mechanical switches, but they had optimism. This prompted me to ask the students if they felt optimism when reflecting on technology, and I received several answers, but most revolved around the concept of enjoyment. I mean, that makes sense. Technology today is almost all about entertainment. But I still pushed further to see, is there even a hint of optimism? And of course, none. Optimism isn't even a memory. It's just not even on the radar. Instead, I heard a series of comments that technology made people selfish, lazy, and bored. Soon followed stories of friends who played video games all day long, others who watched video movies all night long, and then still some who, while playing their video games all day long, were watching the video movies. I don't know how you do that at the same time, but anyway. They actually had to come up with a term for those who die while gaming. There's a handful of people who have actually died because they played video games for several days in a row, and it's called video game exhaustion. That says a lot. The irony is, though, that never has a generation had been more dependent on their technology. Our favorite devices, our iPods, our laptops, our mobile phones, are nearly extensions of our own personal being. I mean, well, and not just for the postmodern, but for the modern as well. You know, ask us to walk out of our home and leave our cell phone. You know, that's unthinkable. Or talk to the kid or the adult who's lost their hard drive, the data on their hard drive. You know, it's devastating. It's absolutely devastating. But still, for my dad, technology was all about society. It was about making life easier and simpler. For us today, technology is all about the individual. It's about making life entertaining and happy. For Dad, technology played a role as a tool. For us, technology plays the role as a servant. We invent technology, but it turns around and reinvents us. As my dad saw in the bright hope of modernity that man had culminated his efforts into walking on the moon, there was an optimism. There was an optimism that technology helped society. And with that optimism came humanity, who wanted to participate and build better society. However, as technology has become more and more personalized, it's become less about society and more about the individual. In our relationship with technology as a culture, its personalization has literally turned our focus inward. Yeah. It's definitely all about me now. So let's look at technology from one more perspective. I really agree with Neil Postman. He wrote this book called Technopoly. I highly encourage you guys to look at it. It's very good. He made a comment that technology changes our perception of reality. That was a bit tough for me to grasp. I didn't think it could be quite so influential. He actually used an example out of the Scientific Revolution. I started interviewing heaps of people, and I was really surprised at how accurate that is. And I think what happens here is that technology, it informs and forms our expectations. So I'll tell you what I mean by that. I think parents have the greatest ability to see this. I had lunch with a friend the other day. We were talking about this topic. She has kids, so I asked her, does technology influence your perception of reality? She got very agitated and relayed a story to me about how she had diligently protected her child from video games. She said one exposure to some car driving video game had quite an impact. Previously, he would ride in the car, sit in his little chair, play until they got to their destination. He's a really laid-back kid. But after the video game, this little tyke had a very different perspective. Mummy, drive the car faster. Mummy, why are you stopping at that light? Mummy, don't cars fly? Can't you make this car fly? I asked her, can't you just tell him in real life cars don't fly? Sure, she said. But explaining the inability of automobiles to go airborne isn't the problem. The problem is that his expectations have changed. This new car flying reality made real car driving really, really boring. But even worse, she explained, it made me boring. I mean, her kid's view of her. So instead of driving around corners with back tires flying off the cliff, you know, she drove like a mom, slow and cautious. Really boring. This is not surprising. Technology speaks to us where we're most vulnerable, at our level of expectations and desires. Incidentally, I think Karl Marx really understood this. It became the foundation for his utopian dream. I think he misunderstood what it means to be human. I'm not a Marxist, but I can certainly see his points. In his understanding, if you can control the expectations, you can control civilization. It is because technology is both informing and forming. But it's not just toddlers who are affected. I have a personal example. In my late teen years, I started noticing that I was walking around with disappointment. Are we going to rate that? That's kind of boring. Sorry. And that other one was just obnoxious. Sorry. It wasn't just that life was disappointing, it was what I was expecting. I wanted a certain ease and comfort and perfection that came in life, that I thought would come in life. It took a little bit of self-reflection, but it became very clear. I wanted life with background music. I wanted the perfect love, the perfect job, the perfect hair, the perfect, you know, whatever, all with Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings somehow mysteriously rising from the trees, you know? I wanted the feeling, everything. Well, I think I really came to terms with the fact pretty early in my 20s then that movies were really influencing my expectations. What was so shocking to me is that initially, I mean, I didn't even notice. It took me quite a lot of work to actually figure out and make the connection of where I was being influenced. Okay. Sorry, I'm a little bit married to my notes here. I've given you three ways that I think technology really influences humanity. It's in its unintended consequences. In its cyclical force, it produces side effects and dissatisfaction, and its ability to reinvent culture, and its ability to change your perception of reality. So I would like to consider a few things. Considering those, I'd like to look at a few things in the postmodern posture. First, let's look at autonomy. When I say autonomy, I don't mean an individual who makes independent decisions. We all do that. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean a person who has abandoned the meta-narrative of God and has replaced it with their own story. Tim's whole presentation in after lunch is actually on the loss of meta-narrative, so I'm not going to go into it. But at the heart of it is this concept that no longer am I a creature who's created by God and his story, but that I'm the creator, and it's all about me creating my story. Let me illustrate this with interesting new technology. Have you all heard about the virtual reality called Second Life? Yeah, some of you have. Okay. Let me explain it. It is literally a second life, but it's in cyberspace. Basically, you become a member. You create your online identity called an avatar. Incidentally, avatar means reincarnation in Hindu. So you're literally going in and reinventing yourself in second life. And then you start living. It has its own economy with real money. It's shocking to me. I couldn't even believe it. Anyway, it's absolutely shocking. You can purchase virtual property with real money. An island will cost you about $1,675. Isn't that great? I don't even know if you get a certificate. I mean, I don't know. It just seems to me really, really extraordinary. You can find a spouse. The spouse can be totally different than your real-life spouse. And you can have kids. And you have a job and whatnot. So let me read something to you that I found on their website. Welcome to Second Life. We look forward to seeing you in your world. Second Life is about personal expression, and your avatar is the most personal expression of all. After all, an avatar is your persona in the virtual world. It is easy to create your avatar, despite offering almost infinite possibilities. The tools to personalize your avatar is very simple and easy to use, and it allows you to change anything you like, from the tip of your nose to the tint of your skin. Don't worry if it's not perfect at first. You can change your look at any time. That spoke volumes to me. I mean, how attractive to be able to become perfect somewhere. I've not participated in Second Life, but I can see it becoming for teens what movies became for me regarding expectations. Live in a land where you are in control, where you can be perfect, and where it's all about self-expression. Imagine how that would translate, especially in the thoughts of kids' minds. Imagine how that translation happens with expectations brought from cyber life to real life. I'm not saying that Second Life is evil. Certainly not. Only what are the real issues? The incentives and risks in virtual life are different than they are in real life. Morality, laws, cultural taboos, they have no connection. There are no real consequences in cyberland. The life has been removed out of the life. Now I can be my own hero. I can be my own author. I can create my story. What's wrong with that? I think living in a post-structural society where there is a lack of community within which one learns morality, and in light of the various ways humanity is influenced by technology, this concerns me deeply. I'm assuming that this will concern others. Don't misunderstand me. It is not that we are better people in real reality. Real life does not make us more righteous, but it makes us more human. There's no act of loving or dying to oneself in cyberspace. Second Life is all about what you want. Anonymity. Technology, especially cyberspace, provides anonymity. An example is internet pornography. At first, I thought it was the accessibility of internet porn that was so problematic. In studying this topic, I've changed my mind. Certainly, it's more accessible. 10 years ago, to get pornography, somebody would have to make an effort in obtaining it. That would involve distance, time, energy, strategy. Walking down to the corner market, driving the car to the hidden parking lot. But the internet has completely removed this process. It has made it instantly accessible. That's concerning because quite possibly a lot of really good decisions were made in that process. Someone, before they actually get to the store, can turn around and go home. It gave them space. But that's actually not my biggest concern. The greater concern is that it removed the human interaction. It gives an illusion of being consequences-free. After all, no real human is involved. It's just an image. Not only is the person seeking the experience to be anonymous, but the image on the other side is anonymous. Lastly, alienation. I think we've become aware of the irony that our favorite devices, which we use to connect us, is also the same thing that alienates us. iPods, mobile phones, etc. They separate us from those in our own geography. But we have to consider that they also alienate us from ourselves. It's interesting that at a time where loneliness and depression is absolutely rampant, solitude is almost completely absent. We're not alone with our thoughts. I find the MySpace and Facebook phenomena to be very interesting. This is actually a huge shift from when I was growing up. My dreams went into the hokey little purple plastic-bound diary with the key. Hid the diary under the pillow. The key went somewhere else. But today, today we have MySpace and Facebook. Not everyone, but many, share publicly what I dare say should be wrestled with privately. An effort to receive validation and significance cannot be obtained by publishing on the internet what should be wrestled with in solitude. Okay, so my conclusion. Are we going to hell in an email attachment? I know. Darn, I hit send. It's too late. This sounds very bleak. Maybe a little depressing. I don't know. I think in an effort to make life simpler, we've actually made it much thinner. In our everyday lives, we should be forced to come to terms with ourselves, our struggles, our flaws, our unmet expectations. Technology completely undermines this struggle. Its goal is to provide an answer, a solution, a fix. But what I have discovered in all the conversation actually gives me a lot of hope. The key point with technology is you have to ask, what are we trying to fulfill? What are we trying to fulfill by this certain form of technology? And it's really important to understand where the postmodern is coming from. We stay connected because we're looking for community. We get Facebook because we're looking for identity and significance. I think we're beginning to realize that technology can do violence to our humanity. It hasn't stolen our humanity, but it is a powerful force. Unfortunately, the more familiarity with technology sometimes translates into loss of objectivity. But I think hope comes from the interaction. And this is kind of the place where we want to cue the Hallmark music. There's no way for me to say this and not sound trite. But like the problem of technology itself, the answer, I think, completely transcends all generations. We need to keep talking between the generations. We need to be human. And that is, of course, one thing that, regardless of what generation you come from, we all have in common. We are all human. We need to engage. Obviously, I'm not going to be prescriptive here. I'm not even going to tell you to kill your television as much as I'd like to. But we need to be human, modern or postmodern. Lastly, just before Wes comes up, David, you mentioned last night that your greatest hope was that you could, through the Gutenberg curriculum, influence some of the students. And I can't tell you how much Gutenberg has been, without a doubt, the most redeeming experience of my life. I've been able to come to terms with certain technology, the authority, and various issues. I've got a much better idea of what it means to be human. And thank you. So, okay.
Thanks. Last night, I argued that that there was a very real sense in which our trust in knowledge is, and our sense of the worth of knowledge and our facility with language and how that relates to knowledge is dimming. Mm-hmm. You seem to be intimating that in what you're saying. Would you agree with where I was going with that last night?
Absolutely. That would have... there just wasn't even enough time to incorporate that. But the whole diminishment of language is just pretty shocking, from the 1950s to the, you know, emoticon text message. Can you solve life's issues in a text message? Yeah. It just, yet that's for many, that's the framework within, not only within which they communicate, but also I'm finding within which that they think.
Could you talk, what do you mean by that, the way they think?
Well, for myself, coming to Gutenberg, one of the aspects that made it so redeeming is because I actually found a vocabulary and a framework within which to understand myself and the questions I should even be asking. All my television watching, and maybe it was what I was watching, I'm sure, but all my television watching, the books I was reading and whatnot, didn't give me a framework to wrestle with. It didn't even give me a vocabulary to wrestle with the issues that I needed to wrestle with. So it wasn't until studying, and especially in the great books, that I finally started to be able to put things into a context with which I could actually start thinking and actually start growing and coming to terms with certain things.
You were using the astounding example for many of us of the phenomenon of second life. Mm. By the way, how many people here have even heard of that term?
Wow. Okay. A lot of you have. Okay.
This is kind of a random question, but does your general skepticism, your general pessimism about the culture of technology being able to, I mean, that it tends to shrink language down. Do you think that would hold true in the virtual world? I mean, do you have any sense of how interplay and interaction in such a virtual world could be in some sense, it's virtual and therefore mm-hmm. not real. But in terms of education or language, what do you think about that?
Well, certainly it could be a venue. I mean, with anything, it could be a venue with which people are able to grow and learn.
Is there something else going on, though, in that whole dynamic?
The whole dynamic of Second Life that was so striking to me is it wasn't, I'm going to go into my virtual world to go figure out what it means to be human, or to go figure out life's deep questions, maybe. But it's the postmodern effort of, well, for me, and it's probably different than the college student today, but for me it's becoming perfect. Okay. That's just incredibly okay. attractive.
Okay. So if there were any, and speak not only for yourself, but maybe put yourself in the shoes of the larger world around you mm-hmm. for your generation. Do you think they see, how do they look at technology and even the power of the images, this whole topic?
Well, tying this into my comment before, I mean, what do we have left? You know, you remove the meta-narrative, we remove interest in being this, you know, productive member of society. I'm my own project. I'm my best project. And it seems like that's what we've been told all our lives. Be all that you can be. And so that's where I've been taught and where I've believed initially that that's where I should be putting all my efforts. And cyber life, where you can actually go in and create this perfect life, that's really attractive. But, you know, there's quite a bit of difference. I mean, for me, I'm 36. I have to say I probably have one foot firmly planted in modernity and then one foot firmly planted in post-modernity. So I'm kind of schizo about many of these things. But, you know, I don't know that it would be as attractive to the 17-year-old as it would be to the disappointed late 20, early 30-something-year-old.
What would be disappointing?
If I think hanging out in cyber life okay. and getting that life that you were told, you know, being happy and whatnot, would be really attractive to people in their late 20s and early 30s, because so many of them are disappointed. They okay. they bought the line, you can be happy, it's all about you. Okay. And then they get into cyber world, and at least there they have some control over that.
So again, thinking in terms of not just yourself, but the larger mm-hmm. culture, of your generation do you think regarding the topic of, say, the power of images and how images, both just images themselves, how the difference between an image communicates and a word or a sentence communicates, and then regard, especially in the power of a moving image. Do you think that that this surrounding generation looks positively at that new emerging language of images, or are they ambivalent about it? Or did they
No, certainly not ambivalent. Well, first of all, there's something really interesting. A word-based language means I have something to dialogue with. An image-based language, I think, only brings expectations, or only communicates expectations. And yet, I think for people who are trying to find themselves, it's something to anchor in. It's something to look at. Walter mentioned that TV was really useful in the sense of my home life is really screwed up, but hey, I can watch whatever TV show and see what real life's all about, see how it's supposed to work. So I think for many of us, those moving images gave us some kind of sense of what we think reality should look like.
And your personal view of the way moving images, video, film, music video, and then certainly the large cinematic productions, very powerful.
Oh, it's so powerful. I mean, give me a book, and there's a chance where I can go through. I'm dealing with the background music that's in my head. Sometimes that's not always healthy, but I'm dealing with myself and the words on the page. I can, through that, I can kind of dialogue with it in my mind. I can come to terms with it. I can ask questions of it. I can find the bias of what it's saying. Give me a movie, and it's I don't know. I mean, to me, it feels really manipulative. It's like I'm telling you what to feel. I'm telling you, I'm leading you through a story to a conclusion, and this is how I want you to interact.
And you think that power lies strictly in the mode of the images, because there is a dialogue, there is a script going on. There is a possible, some sort of narrative that's being unfolded.
Absolutely, but I mean, there's not. I can step back after the film and try to get. I think music in film with the images is incredibly powerful. But I can step back, consider the content of the film, but what do I have to work with? If I go download the script online and start really working with it, I mean, I can work with the general story and the general movement of it, but it's powerful. It's influential, I think, more than it is dialoguing, personally.
Okay. Well, we actually have the opportunity to be really close to being on time here.
Yeah, we should do
so
that.
I know there are a ton of questions that you all have not had a chance to raise, and particularly about this issue of technology and image and that whole culture. So I think we'll just ask you to hold those, but be sure to bring them up in the larger question and answer time later this afternoon. And thank you very much, Casey.
Thanks. Yeah.